The views and opinions expressed on today's show are solely those of the individual speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official positions of the American Solidarity Party. The official party platform can be found under the About Us page on the American Solidarity Party website, solidarity-party.org. You're listening to The Pelican Brief, the official podcast of the American Solidarity Party, a show dedicated to promoting the common good on common ground through common sense. I'm your host, Bill Fleming.
My guest today is Leah Labresco Sargent. Leah is a writer and speaker and joins me today to talk about building community.
Leah, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself for the listeners who may be unfamiliar with you and your work?
Sure. My name's Leah. I'm a Catholic writer. I'm a convert to Catholicism after growing up as an atheist. And I'm really interested in the ways that we have the power to kind of find third solutions when people tell us we have only a limited number of options or that we have to make our choices from a position of despair. That was a big theme of my second book, Building the Benedict Option, which is all about how can we take one step further into community and care for our neighbor.
What was it that motivated you to write Building the Benedict Option?
Well, part of the reason I wrote it is I was just, doing all the work of researching a book in my life by trying to build up bigger community. And I kept having thoughts on it, and I thought they'd be helpful to other people, so I wrote them down. I'm really interested in community in part because I am a convert. So I've really relied on friends to be my entry point into Catholicism. And I think everyone kind of has this trouble, it's just converts have it more obviously, especially now when people move to a new city after college and find themselves alone, and whether you're Catholic or not, trying to figure out how do I hold on to what's most important in my life without a network of people to support me in living out my values and making good choices. So I was really interested in writing, particularly for folks at that early stage of life where you might be moving a lot, you might not feel like you can put down roots reliably. How do you build community wherever you are over the timescale of 2 weeks to 2 months, not over the timescale of your entire life?
How heavily influenced or inspired were you by Rod Dreher's book, The Benedict Option?
I was really grateful to him for kind of providing a rallying point for this discussion. I think of Rod's book as kind of making the case for community to people who are skeptical of that being important work to be engaged in. Rod's writing most of all for folks who feel like the main way to live a good Christian life is to work through politics to kind of gain the breathing space we need to live as Christians. And Rod's pretty pessimistic about how much politics will lead to that safety in the first place. I had the easier task. I wrote my book thinking, I'm writing for an audience that's already pitched to some extent on wanting deeper community and wanting that to be the foundation of their life. My book is entirely about how to get there. It's a very practical, grounded book.
And yours is more actionable, right? It's not as political.
Yeah, my book is a book where I really hope that no one reads it straight through the first time. My hope, and I invite people to do this in the book, is that you put it down and, talk to a friend about having dinner, or in these times about just even setting up a phone call with a friend you're not in as close touch with during the pandemic. But I want people to put the book down and do something before they finish.
One of the things that Dreher promotes is the idea that Christians should consider engaging in some degree of self-segregation and think about forming intentional communities. Whereas we were talking about, your book is more focused on integrating some of those values and principles into the lives that we're already leading. I was curious to hear if this difference in approach is rooted in the practical issues of intentional community, or if there's a more fundamental disagreement about the value of those types of communities.
I'll speak up for Rod a little here. Forming intentional communities isn't the same thing as retreating from the world. We turn to other people we share values with in part so that we can better live our faith in the broader world. People who form a close friendship don't become closed off from the world, but their friendship might provide them the courage or support to take bigger chances. I think where Rod and I disagree most is, I think that whatever we do, we have to do it in a way that really is an invitation to others, even people who don't share all of our political commitments. There's something about the saints where people always report a sense of peace and wonder about many of them, that there's a sense of whatever's going on there, there's something I know I'm invited into. I think sometimes, you know, in Rod's writing, you know, he's writing with the sense that we have enemies that are kind of implacable enemies. But, you know, some of the folks he most admires, like Vaclav Benda, were people who opened their door in the middle of persecution, including two of their persecutors or people who had betrayed them to the secret police. And as Christians, when we form intentional communities, you know, it should be clear that our door is always open to people in need. We may not agree with them. We may have serious disagreements about what the good is. But if you're hungry, if you're cold, if you're tired, you should look at me and think, Leah will open her door to me.
And what is the best way for us to get that message out there to others that is, you know, who we are, that we are available for that, and that they can approach us?
Well, one thing I do is that I really make a point when I'm talking to friends who are Christian of not parting from them without praying together. You know, and I do this partly because I have a bad habit as someone who's sometimes into over-intellectualizing things of thinking about God without talking to God. So when I'm with friends, I don't want to kind of wind up talking a lot about philosophy or even theology or especially politics and not actually pray for the people we're discussing or the causes we're talking about. But I've also found that when I ask my friends, what can I pray for you? They often invite me a lot deeper into their lives than when I don't ask. You know, I'll have had a 40-minute conversation with someone and not have heard the thing that's most on their mind until I ask, what can I pray for you? And when I say it, you know, they ask me and then I have to often admit something that I haven't brought up either. So I think, you know, for Christians, prayer together is the biggest way of demonstrating we're open to other people's needs as a way of just even starting that conversation among friends. But for everyone, being more open about your own needs, including small needs that feel like you could do without people's help, but you don't have to, is a way of normalizing that we need each other. And the more you give small needs to your friends and accept their small needs, the more comfortable everyone feels asking for big needs. So that's kind of what to do on the interpersonal level. On the political level, you know, we want to make sure that we're receptive to the needs of our neighbors, and that means encountering our neighbors. I've joined the mutual aid network in my town, you know, so I get an email every week so I can be a lot more attentive to not just what are the national political causes that I may want to donate to or volunteer for, but immediately in my community, what does, you know, my neighbor down the street need and what do people in my community need? And you know, that's meant donating everything from diapers to dropping off stamps for folks who were in quarantine.
With respect to asking for the little things that we think, you know, may not be significant enough and being conscientious about that, to what degree are we victims of our own affluence where we retreat into ourselves because we don't need help on those things?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a real reason that we say that there's a kind of frankness in undeniable need. And there's a gift in that, you know, when we have needs that are undeniable, we're not tempted to lie to ourselves that we're invulnerable or that we're different from other people who need something in this moment. And the more comfortable you are, you know, the more spiritual danger you can be in, because it's possible to look around and go, well, you know, I'm able-bodied, I'm healthy, I'm financially comfortable. Maybe that's because I'm better than everyone else. And that's not true. And everyone is vulnerable at different times. But, you know, periods of sustained comfort are very dangerous for letting us think of the vulnerable as totally different from us, and that we will never again kind of live in the land of the sick.
Mm-hmm. And that our community degrades because we don't rely on each other. And then when we do find ourselves vulnerable, we don't have that community to turn to.
It kind of varies. You know, sometimes a big calamity like the one we're going through now really revitalizes a community. And that's something that Rebecca Solnit has written about in a really fascinating book called Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. So there are moments where, with other supports taken away and just the raw fact of our need, people really come out. You know, people worry about looting or rioting after disaster, but that's much rarer than people just, you know, forming communal kitchens to take care of each other. So if we picture what happens after a disaster, it's more often care than chaos. Now, the more and more attenuated your community is, you know, the more chaos kind of opens its door, the more one person or a particular group of people may be left out of that care after a disaster. But, you know, we should be a little more optimistic about each other than we sometimes are. Tough times bring out a lot of good in people, but we don't want to live our lives kind of inviting tough times as the only way we remember to care about each other.
Has COVID influenced or changed the way that you think about building community in a practical sense?
Well, it's limited a lot of my options, which is really frustrating as someone who, you know, had, like everyone else, big plans for this year. But what I've tried to be attentive to is, where is it opening options that I would have otherwise neglected, you know, for the neighbors I can walk to, for just my street itself. I've met a lot more people on my street because I set up not just, I joined the mutual aid listserv for our whole neighborhood, but I set up a mutual aid listserv just for our street so that people could, you know, serve the folks who were absolutely nearest to them, where we kind of can't deny our responsibility for each other. So, you know, I pray both that the pandemic ends soon, and I pray that whatever good's been brought out of it is something I'm faithful to when I'm not forced to be.
A lot of people have turned to, you know, technology because of COVID to stay connected to others while responsibly physically distancing ourselves. But technology, and specifically social media, often get blamed for an increase in social isolation and a degradation of the community. Do you agree with that characterization? And what thoughts do you have about how we can best use technology to build authentic connections?
I think we absolutely can use technology to build thicker, productive community. But it's not a neutral tool. And often I wouldn't even say it's a positively inflected tool. You know, the thing to remember is that when you're using technology, especially if you're using a service that is free, it means that the person who designed this service is selling access to your attention. And they may not have the same goals for you as you do in using, let's say, Twitter. I kind of trust more communities that I pay for access to, because then I know the person developing this community is attentive to the needs of their customers, not the needs of their advertisers. So I've been making sure to support writers I like on Substack. I also, I will say, have a Substack in case anyone is interested in doing book clubs for long form articles, and people are welcome to pay me there. It's tinybookclub.substack.com. I want to pay people directly when I see content I like or creativity I like. I pay for Feedly, an RSS reader, to support the people who are developing good things and keep them focused on the folks who use their service. And then when I do use technology, I want to use it mindful of what my goal is and being attentive to what the site designer's goal for me is. I have an unusually good experience with Twitter, as far as I can tell, because I read people I admire primarily. And if I read someone frequently who just makes me angry, I pray for them and then I take them off my list, because I don't need a website to show me people behaving badly all day. Liz Brunig said a great thing about this, which is it kind of gives us a God's eye view of the sinfulness of the world without God's mercy or justice or power. So I think kind of narrowing in on what is my goal in this technology and how can I have it deepen friendships or connect me to people I admire? How do I make it so that when I log on to the site, I feel like it's helping me become a better person?
And do you have any actionable advice in terms of using that technology to facilitate conversations and maybe connect other people with each other so that it's not just a one-on-one conversation, but it's a community building exercise?
One thing I like to do is I like to bring people around something that is good, so that instead of just having, you know, a way, oh, well, we've gotten together, let's talk about whatever's on our mind, knowing that often whatever's on our mind is kind of more clickbaity or cheap political content, I'm more likely to say to my friends, wow, I've read this essay that's really great. Does anyone else want to have a call to talk about it? Or, you know, even just the way I open conversations with friends is often, what's something really good you've read recently? Or what have you been thinking about? So starting from what is good that you both want to move together towards? I've heard people talk about friendship is like a triangle, right? Where you and your friend both become closer to each other as you move towards some third thing you both admire. I've really enjoyed using Facebook to have long-form book clubs for big, meaty books we might not tackle on our own, like Kristen Laverne's Daughter. And I've become much closer friends to folks I didn't know as well after hearing their thoughts for months about this book. And of course, my Substack is entirely about what if we gather around writing that's really good? Because I think often we spend the most time with the writing that ticks us off and don't elevate or really sit with the writing that makes us better.
A lot of young families who are listening to this conversation may have concerns about properly integrating their children into their efforts of connecting with others, getting involved and building local community. What advice or tips do you have for people who may find themselves in that situation, especially today with concerns about COVID?
I think it varies a lot, you know, based on the disposition of your particular child. I was a weird child who loved talking to adults and having conversations with them. Other kids, you know, may feel a little more standoffish. And right now it's hard to figure out, you know, exactly what to do, but there are plenty of ways we can socialize safely. It'll get harder in the winter. But if you're outside, if you're spaced reasonably far apart, you know, if there's good ventilation, that's not that dangerous. You know, when you're outside, masks are less important, but you know, if it's comfortable to use, you can use them, or you can just move further apart. There are ways we can get together without putting each other in danger. So you don't need to resign yourself to not seeing your friends. And that being said, in the winter, it's harder. So, you know, you may want to invest in a good thermos or like the March girls from Little Women, make hot apple turnovers and carry them out as you go for an outside walk with your friend and keep your hands warm. But I think, you know, again, kind of focusing on what do people need and how can my friendship be about serving that need? Talking to your friends and going, wow, this has been really hard. You know, what I'm struggling with is loneliness. You know, what I'm struggling with is, you know, I miss getting to joke around with people. What I'm struggling with, especially for single people, sometimes is not just loneliness, but the loneliness that comes with not seeing any children. This was hard for me before I was married as someone who loves kids. So I'd visit friends with kids a lot and babysit. And so to say, you know, can I, you know, go with you and catch up a little at a playground and I'll sit, you know, two benches away and we'll talk to each other and I'll get to see your kids. And I guess the thing that we've found has been helpful is just kind of making good rules for the kids that are easier for them to follow. So we made a little line made out of shoes or sticks. And we're like, that's the coronavirus line. You can't step over it. And for a lot of the kids, that was doable for them. So don't give up on seeing your friends. Take some appropriate precautions, space yourself out. But, you know, it doesn't need to be a winter that's spent totally alone.
What would be the first thing you would recommend to somebody who's feeling that loneliness or social isolation, but they have trouble finding people to form connections with, whether that's because of, you know, maybe the area they live in, or they've moved to a new place and they're getting settled? What would be the first step?
It's pretty hard, especially right now, because you can't rely on some of the things you might have done, which is, you know, what's going on at my church? What's going on at my library? Where will I run into people who share some interests with me and get to talk to them? It wouldn't be crazy to just put a message in several of your neighbors' mailboxes to say, I'm new to the area. This is my name. This is my email. This seems like a really good time to get to know neighbors. So if you want to, you know, make cocoa and, you know, talk on the sidewalk sometime, let me know. And you may not find that your neighbors are your favorite people, but wherever you are, if you're lonely, there's no way that you're the only lonely person, you know, within even a few blocks of you. And you don't know how much you'll wind up helping someone by admitting that you're a little lonely and giving them the space to ask for you to come see them. So that's my biggest piece of advice. Like, ask someone to talk, even if they're not the person you're most interested in. Now, I think if you're looking beyond just your street or whoever's right around you, or if you're, you know, looking beyond maybe getting in touch with an old friend from school, it is worth looking at whatever your local library is doing. You know, my library is having online programs, and it's the kind of place where librarians are really excellent people who connect folks to books, who connect folks to social workers, to social resources. And if you kind of come around a little, even online, and then say, I'm really new to the area and I don't know what to do, that might be one of the best places for finding someone who can give you good advice that's particular to you and to where you live.
One thing that we talked about earlier in the conversation was you mentioned that when you're with other Christians, you don't leave, you don't say goodbye without praying together. What is something that we can do with our friends who may not share the same faith that we do that can be done in a similar or same vein? You know, my experience is most of my friends who aren't Christians will appreciate it when I ask them what I can pray for them or, you know, those kind of things. But in terms of what you can do together.
Well, I think one thing you can do that's kind of a sneakier thing is you can say, you know, when I'm with Christian friends, I ask this because I really want to pray for my friends and I want to know what's going on in their lives. Is there something that would be a good thing for me to ask you? And you can just ask your friend and say, like, I want to know about my friends. I want to care about them and help where I can. So is there a way I can ask that that makes sense to you in your context as someone who's not Christian? But if you don't feel comfortable asking as directly, I think the best way of kind of eliciting other people's needs is to talk a little about your own. And then to kind of say, this is, I've been, had one thing that's just really been troubling me. Can I talk to you a little about it? And then say, gosh, thank you. And say, is there anything that's been troubling you that you want to talk to me about?
In terms of connecting with people who are not like us, you know, that that is a big barrier to some people. What role do you think our kind of our individualistic culture and lack of national solidarity plays into that? And how, what is the way that we can best de-otherize those who may have less in common with us?
What I find helpful for myself is, you know, remembering that everyone acts for the sake of a perceived good. That when I'm mad at someone or confused by them, I can go, wow, is this person just deliberately doing the worst thing they can think of? And the answer is no, almost always. People act for the sake of a perceived good. Everyone wants to be a good person. Everyone wants to have a positive impact on the world, but they disagree about what that is. And so my challenge for myself is, what good is this person trying to do in whatever weird or baffling or infuriating thing they're doing? And often if what they're doing is kind of antagonizing me, you know, since I don't think it's good for the world to just deliberately be unpleasant to me, I'd say, okay, this person is being a big jerk to me, probably because they're defending something they think is important from me. So what good is it that they value that they think I endanger? And I try and really take that question seriously because I find it easier both to like people and to see people when I remember that they act for the sake of a perceived good.
When we see people pushing others away and not expressing that solidarity, you know, nationally, because they're afraid of a loss of something, what is the best way that we can reach out to those people and not necessarily kind of change their opinion, but show them how that is detrimental to actually creating a cohesive society?
Well, I just don't know that anyone cares that much about a cohesive society over and above whatever they value, you know, as a good society. So, you know, I think sometimes the pitch for just civility or pleasantness is a hard pitch to make because, you know, folks who are defending something they think is really important, even when they're defending it wrongly, don't want to wait, don't want to put that aside in order to engage in pleasantries with people they think may be complicit in grave evil. You know, there's a quote from William Lloyd Garrison that I'm trying to pull up here, you know, that's against moderation, where he's, you know, basically telling people, sadly, I am not finding, oh, there it is, where he's speaking against kind of a call to moderation or civility, because he says, on this subject, and he's talking about slavery, I do not wish to think or write or speak with moderation. No, tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hand of the ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. And I find this helpful, and I don't think he's wrong. Even for people who are, I think, wrong politically, I don't think, you know, fearing moderation as a diminution of our duty to others who are in danger is crazy. So I guess the way I kind of try and lower the temperature of a discussion, you know, can even be to talk about that quote and say, you know, I understand that, you know, your perspective is that this is a life and death issue, and, you know, I disagree or I'm on the opposite side of it. I'd like to have a conversation with you about it. And I understand that even debating this question may seem unfair or unreasonable to you. Is there a way we can make space? Because, you know, I think we'd both like to convince each other, what would it take for us to be able to have this conversation? And to really take that seriously. You know, people who say I shouldn't have to debate slavery, I shouldn't have to debate the worth of Black people, are correct. They should not have to. Now, these fights are won by some people being willing to debate people who are in good faith and on the wrong side, but not everyone is expected to take that on. And when you ask someone to take that on in order to talk to you, you're asking a big thing. So be mindful of how big a sacrifice it can be to quietly and civilly talk about the dignity of other human beings.
Yeah, I suppose cohesive is a poor choice of words on my part there. I think I totally agree with everything you just said. But at the same time, the issue is the dignity of everyone, right? And so that's the primary area of concern that I'm considering when I'm thinking about that question.
Well, I think abortion is a good example of an issue where these conversations are really hard because, you know, both groups feel that the other side's entire premise doesn't allow the dignity of a certain group of people to count. You know, and pro-lifers are talking about the dignity of children, you know, before birth. And people who are pro-choice who don't have that same faith in the dignity of the unborn and, you know, who I think the best thing I can say, take seriously what an anti-woman and anti-child culture we live in, so that pregnancy and children carry a much heavier burden than they should in a just society. And they say, well, given what it means to be pregnant, to have a child, you know, we live in a world that tells women that they can't do this, and then truly makes it much harder than it should be so that abortion feels like the only way to exist in the world as a woman. And if you take abortion off the table, then women can't exist in the work world, in other places. You know, and I'd love to be able to say, no, no, you're totally wrong. We live in a culture that's friendly to women. And I can't, because it's not true. So I think that's where, you know, it's hardest to have the conversation because both groups fear that if they, you know, give a little ground, then the entire dignity of a person is eclipsed.
So if people are interested in staying informed about what you're working on, where can they follow you?
You can find me on my website at lealabresco.com. That's my pre-marriage name, but I haven't bought another URL since then. And you can join me for discussions of just good writing with people who want to take ideas seriously and are willing to hear each other out at tinybookclub.substack.com.
All right, Leah, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share this podcast with your friends and family and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.
Today's episode of The Pelican Brief will be the last released in 2020. Our next episode will be released on January 4th, 2021. Tune in to hear my conversation with Todd Dethridge of the Telos Group. Thank you for listening. And I want to wish you all a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.